Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening. Thank you for coming. This is our ninth and final program in the Henrietta Lacks series. And it's also the 50th Exploring Ethics program convened here at the Reuben H. Fleet Science Center. I'm Mike Kalichman. I'm director of the Center for Ethics in Science and Technology and a professor at UC San Diego. By coincidence, tonight marks, as I've said, two events. The first one is this was scheduled as a capstone event in the Henrietta Lacks series, culminating 9 months of community-wide activities around the book The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Second, we just recently realized that tonight is actually the 50th program we've held at the Fleet Science Center, which has very generously provided us with this venue for several years now, since May of 2008. I had some wonderful slides that showed you all of those programs before, but we didn't quite get the technology to work tonight. We'll hopefully have that working next time. To help us mark those two events, we turn to UC San Diego, which is one of three institutions, along with San Diego State University and University of San Diego, that have been primary supporters for the Ethics Center for the period of 2006 to 2011. I asked the Chancellor if she could join us tonight to introduce the program, which she was happy to do, but some urgent travel came up, and so she isn't going to be able to make it tonight. But she turned to the Vice Chancellor for Research, Sandra Brown, and asked her if she'd be able to make it. And Sandy, despite the short notice, graciously agreed to join us tonight. So she is here. Sandy became Vice Chancellor for Research in December of 2010 at UCSD. And more personally, I find her presence at this program particularly gratifying because it underlines the fundamental connection between academic research and scholarly activity on the one side and what we're trying to do with the mission for the Ethics Center and the conversations in these programs. So to welcome you this evening further, I would please welcome Sandy Brown.
Thank you, Mike, and welcome to everyone here this evening. I am so pleased to have the opportunity to make a few remarks before we hear from this august panel of students this evening. Ethics is defined as both the science of moral duty and the philosophic study of moral values and rules. Many of you know His Holiness the Dalai Lama recently visited San Diego and shared his quiet wisdom and his gentle humor with audiences at the three major universities that Mike just mentioned. And speaking of the ethical dilemmas of science and technology, the Dalai Lama has emphasized that while modern science and technology have given us the ability to prolong life, each case must be considered in light of reason and compassion, taking into account all circumstances. Scientists and others must proceed with caution and with humility and to be aware of their own potential for their work, including human subjects research, the focus of this evening's panel, for potential abuse. The motivation of our work, the Dalai Lama has said, should be compassion, not utility. While we need laws and international codes of conduct, mostly we need individuals to have an awareness of the harm that our practices may inflict on humans and on animals. Scientists must be motivated by ethical restraint as well as compassion. And how well we adhere to the principles espoused by the Dalai Lama is partly why we are here this evening. The Exploring Ethics in Henrietta Lacks series has been an extraordinary collaboration. It's a collaborative venture that demonstrates the value of scientific integrity, diversity, and interdisciplinary excellence. The Lacks series alliance of science and education partners could only have happened in San Diego, I think, because of our region's emphasis on collaboration and innovation that is combined with our commitment to understanding and evaluating ethics in the context of research. I want to congratulate the Ethics Center and its partners for the success in the LAC series and for reaching this wonderful milestone of the 50th Exploring Ethics Forum in partnership with the Reuben H. Fleet Science Center this evening. And I also would like to give a special thanks to Mike Kalichman, who recently was honored with the UCSD's Chancellor's Associates Faculty Excellence Award for Community Service. Tonight's forum is an example of his commitment and of that service. And finally, I'd like to offer my best wishes to the student panelists this evening. They're from the UC San Diego Student Society for Medical Ethics. We are very proud of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sandy. So for our program tonight, Dr. Dina Plemons, who I think is sitting right there, conceived the idea that we should have a capstone event for this series that involves students as a proper way to do that. Dr. Plemons is of both UC San Diego and San Diego State University, so she's an emblem of what we're trying to do with the Center of collaborations between the institutions. The students that are here are several highly motivated participants in UCSD's Student Society for Medical Ethics, and they agreed to form tonight's panel. That society was created by students at UCSD under the guidance of Dr. Mary Devereaux, a longtime friend and a member of UCSD's Research Ethics Program. Dr. Devereaux is a philosopher and bioethicist with the program. She's also director of UCSD's Biomedical Ethics Seminar Series. She's a health law program coordinator, adjunct professor of law at California Western School of Law, and a member of UCSD Medical Center at Hillcrest Hospital Ethics Committee. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Devereaux, who will introduce our panel and moderate this evening's discussion.
Thank you, Mike, and welcome, everyone. I'm very, very pleased tonight to introduce the three members of the Student Society for Medical Ethics, which we started about in 2009, I believe it was. And I will confess that when I founded this group, the idea was to have a forum for medical students to talk about medical ethics. And after some efforts in this direction, I discovered that, in fact, most of the attendees of this new society were indeed undergraduates and a handful of graduate students, and rarely did we ever see a medical student. And when I inquired, I was told the medical students were too busy to do this. So a group of undergraduates sort of took this over. They run annual conferences and a number of other events, and this is, as Mike said, something extra we asked them to do. So let me introduce our three panelists. The first is Dong Trang. Dong is, as all of them are, a senior about to graduate from UCSD and a member of the society. He is presently the conference director for the society, and he's a major in biochemistry and philosophy, which I'm particularly happy to report. And next year, he will be doing graduate studies in the Division of Biology here at UCSD, so I'm pleased we're not losing him. Next to Dong is Nitin Prabhakar, who is a senior also. He is a neuroscience major and a minor in something at UCSD called Social Issues of Healthcare. He's also planning to apply to medical school in the next couple of years, and his position in the Student Society is vice president. And then last, to my far left, is Michael Cheng. He is a double major in a program called Physiology and Neuroscience and also in psychology. And like his fellows, he is also going into the sciences. In his case, he's going to be doing a master's program in biology here at UCSD. So it is my great pleasure to introduce all three of them. And let me just conclude with a brief anecdote that after Dina had proposed that we do a capstone event with students, there was some discussion, I will not mention among whom, that indeed we needed to worry about this proposed idea, because although we had put it on the program, the concern was that if we announced that our speakers were not faculty or leading lights of the local community, as is our usual process, that no one would turn out. And I'm happy to report that that worry came to nothing. So thank you and welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Dover, for the wonderful introduction, and welcome everyone to the final forum in the Henry Lacks series. In the past few months, we've discussed various topics, all related to the book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. We've explored concepts of immortality from different religious perspectives, discussed the importance of understanding science and successful treatment of ailments, and we're even fortunate enough to hear Rebecca Skloot talk about her motivations and goals in writing the story of Henrietta Lacks, her family, and those involved in the development of the HeLa cell line. Tonight, our topic is Human Subjects Research, a look at past, present, and future. Recently, details emerging concerning a past event, the 1940s Guatemala STD study, have emerged. This study has been under ethical scrutiny of late. We will take a look at the details of this historical case and the response to it by the scientific community and the Obama administration. We will then end with a look at a current study conducted by Maria Luisa Zuniga, a researcher here at San Diego, which shows effective partnering between researchers and human research subjects. While the relationship in Skloot's book is one between patient and physician, and that in the examples that Nitin and Michael will discuss is one between human research participants and researcher, the issues of vulnerability of subjects and researchers' respect for the participants in their studies echoes the issues that were seen in Henrietta Lacks' case. While all of you here tonight probably know Henrietta Lacks' story, I quickly want to summarize it with an eye to some of the issues relevant to tonight's discussion. Henrietta Lacks came to Johns Hopkins Hospital to check up on pain that she was having and discovered that she had cervical cancer. During her time there, two dime-sized pieces of her cervix were removed and given to a researcher by the name of Dr. George Guy without her permission. At that time, and still is today, tissue removed from a patient is no longer theirs. It's basically regarded as medical waste. Thus, it is permissible to use it in research without the patient's consent. The cells taken from Henrietta Lacks eventually produced the first immortal cell line, known as the HeLa cell line. Guy distributed the cells to other researchers, and by the 1950s, HeLa cells were used in hundreds of labs all across the world. Much like the vulnerable individuals used as subjects in the Guatemalan STD study, Henrietta Lacks was uneducated, poor, and part of a minority group. Henrietta Lacks didn't ever study, let alone understand, science. The book notes that she, like other African Americans at the time, was afraid to question the judgment of Caucasian professionals. Issues of vulnerability, understanding science, and respect for patients all come into play in her story. Use of the HeLa cell line led to many important innovations in modern science, from the vaccine for polio to discoveries in cancer and AIDS. However, before The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks was released, little was known about the woman behind the cells and her story. Skloot's book and the Lacks series that we conclude tonight in some way expresses gratitude for Henrietta's contributions to science. Skloot's book in particular helps to paint a picture of Henrietta not as a mere instrument to further science or as a source of cells on a plate, but as an individual with interests, desires, and stories. She was a member of a community, a mother, and part of a family. In this, Henrietta is not alone. Other research subjects have their own stories to tell and lives to live. In the afterword of her book, Rebecca Skloot leaves us with a quote from Sonny Lacks, Henrietta Lacks' son. This quote gives us some insight into the Lacks family's reaction to the overall treatment of Henrietta Lacks by the staff at Johns Hopkins Hospital and the scientific community. Sunny says, quote, "I'm proud of my mother and what she done for science. I just hope Hopkins and some of the other folks who benefited off her cells will do something to honor her and make right with the family." End quote. Here and in other areas of research and healthcare generally, the question of how best to show respect for human subjects arises. In looking back at Henrietta Lacks' story and looking forward at the cases to be presented, we would like you to ponder these issues and to think critically about how we might best respect those who, by their participation, make research possible. Next, I'd like to hand over the stage to Nitin, who will discuss the Guatemala STD study and how these issues are presently under review. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. No doubt the most infamous case of ethical oversight in regards to human subject research in U.S. history was the Tuskegee syphilis study. Over a period of approximately 40 years, researchers observed the natural progression of syphilis in African-American men, withholding treatment even when it became available partway through the trial. Although the United States had condemned the World War II Nazi experiments and helped establish the Nuremberg Code in 1947, unfortunately, the Tuskegee trials continued until 1972. Around the same time of the Tuskegee study, United States Public Health Service physicians and affiliated surgeon generals of the U.S. Navy and Army began another set of syphilis experiments, conducted in Guatemala and approved by the National Research Council. This second study has only recently come to light. Professor Susan Reverby of Wellesley College, in the course of her own research on Tuskegee, uncovered archive papers from a well-known physician and Tuskegee research investigator, Dr. John Cutler. As Reverby learned, here researchers intentionally infected human beings with sexually transmitted diseases. The initial intent of the study was to look for new ways to prevent STDs. The first experiments in Guatemala involved selecting female sex workers with gonorrhea or syphilis and then allowing them to have unprotected sex with soldiers or prison inmates. When few of these men became infected, the research approach changed. They changed to direct injection of soldiers, prisoners, and mental hospital patients with these STDs. Ironically, while institutional officials were aware of the study subjects themselves knew nothing of the purpose of the study and did not provide consent. Indeed, by today's standards, many of the study subjects fell into categories recognized as vulnerable populations. The researchers maintained that they treated the vast majority of subjects. However, close examination of the historical record shows that some of the people of the study subjects were prescribed only partial treatment and some none at all. I'd like to read a quote from the congressional hearing. In quote, "In one case described, a woman who was infected with syphilis was clearly dying from the disease. Instead of treating her, the researchers poured gonorrhea-infected pus into her eyes and other orifices and infected her again with syphilis. She died 6 months later." End quote. Correspondence between the investigators indicates that they and their superiors were aware of the unethical nature of these research studies. Some of the same U.S. government researchers in Guatemala in the 1940s who later actively hid what they were doing and never tried to obtain permission, had obtained consent a few years earlier when conducting similar experiments in Indiana. There, the researchers explained the experiments in advance in detail and experimented only on prisoners who volunteered. The stark contrast between how the U.S. Public Health Service physicians experimented with Americans and Guatemalans clearly shows that the researchers knew their conduct was unethical. In response to these and other abuses, the U.S. government and international bodies have since established clear ethical guidelines governing medical research on human subjects. In response to Reverbery's revelation of these Guatemalan studies, the United States has acknowledged that American doctors denied Guatemalans the respect they deserved as fellow human beings and violated their most basic human rights. President Barack Obama personally called Guatemalan President Alvaro Colom and the U.S. government released a statement apologizing for the actions of the U.S. Public Health Service. Concurrently, President Obama directed the Presidential Commission on Bioethical Issues to investigate the case further. They were charged not only with an analysis of specific historical abuses, but also with reviewing the effectiveness of current U.S. guidelines and international standards for clinical research. I'd like to conclude by summarizing these findings of the 2011 Commission and their recommendations for the future of ethically principled clinical research. They found that U.S.-funded international and domestic research is subject to several statutes, regulations, and guidelines. Some of these guidelines carried the force of law, while others simply exerted a moral influence on the rules that exist today. None of these were in place at the time of the Guatemalan experiments. First, the common rule would have been invoked, a baseline standard that requires researchers to obtain and document informed consent, as well as institutional review board membership and review. FDA rules, good clinical practice guidelines, and international requirements for review by an independent review board likely would have resulted in a finding of intolerable risks. Second, informed consent requirements from the same sources would have required individual consent. Finally, the Department of Health and Human Services rules for research with prisoners and vulnerable populations would have prohibited the work. These rules would have stopped the Guatemalan research before it even started. Another difference between today's research landscape and the one in the 1940s is the education and training of investigators in ethics regarding human subjects. In addition to these standards, institutions and individuals undertaking FDA-regulated research must register their studies in an online database known as clinicaltrials.gov, which provides the public with basic information about study design, results, and serves to facilitate recruitment and assures accountability. The Commission agreed that over the last five decades, significant progress has been made in the development of U.S. policies consistent with international norms for ethical human subject research. They concluded that no new rules are needed at this time. Even so, greater efforts are needed to enhance transparency, monitor ongoing research, and hold researchers and institutions responsible and accountable for any violations. With respect to the issue of informed consent and the egregious violations of human dignity illustrated by the Henrietta Lacks case, Tuskegee, and Guatemala, the Commission recognized the specific importance of informed consent as an essential element in the protection of clinical research subjects. In general, the conduct of clinical research has become a much more open and transparent process than it was 50 to 60 years ago. Lastly, the Commission emphasized the involvement of the community as a vital step in promoting ethical principles, a way of interfacing, a way to protect themselves and become invested in the ethical and valid conduct of research. We'll see an example of this in a minute from Michael. While the Commission stressed the value of community engagement, they made clear, however, that this would not be a substitute for review boards, individual informed consent, or reviews of scientific validity. Revelations of the horrible injustices in Guatemala, as well as in Tuskegee, allow us to use the lessons from the past to shape our present as a community that aims to protect the rights of human research subjects. Thank you.
Thank you. As Nateen outlined, the recently publicized Guatemalan research studies epitomized the wrong approach to working with human subjects. Studies that would be ethically condemned if done in the U.S. should not be taken abroad and carried out on populations in other countries. Regardless of the importance of the scientific goals, under no circumstance should researchers ignore the welfare of study participants. The informed consent of each study participant is a must, and individuals or groups for whom consent would be difficult or impossible should have extra protection or be excluded from research. Regardless of who they are or where they live, every human subject should be treated as a human being, with dignity and with respect. As shown by Nadine's dissection of the report by the Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues, the ethical standards and legal requirements of today are significantly more rigorous than those in the 1940s. In addition to stricter regulation, researchers themselves now demonstrate a far greater awareness of the need to prioritize the well-being of human subjects and observe the standards of responsible conduct of research. To illustrate the advances that the scientific community has made in this respect, I want to use the example of the work of Dr. Maria Luisa Zuniga, a faculty member and researcher at UCSD. We are very pleased that Dr. Zuniga is able to join us tonight. She is with us in the audience. Dr. Zuniga and her associates study barriers to clinical trial participation in the HIV-positive Latino population. In doing so, they use a model of investigation known as community-based participation research. This approach, about which I will say more in a minute, illustrates developments in our thinking about human subjects research. I want to focus on three principles that highlight our progress. One, the necessity to include vulnerable populations in research. Two, the importance of including the perspectives of those studied and partnering with the local communities from which we draw our research participants. And three, an ethical commitment to give back to the communities that make research possible. First, consider the issue of significant inclusion of vulnerable populations in research. Given the history of past abuses, one might conclude that ethical researchers should avoid working with so-called vulnerable populations. In fact, researchers might prefer to avoid working with groups that require overcoming significant regulatory hurdles. Current practice dictates that vulnerable populations should generally be excluded from research recruitment for their protection. However, in order for research results to apply to all members of the population of interest, it is necessary to use a study sample that is broadly represented of the study population. We know that behavior and effective treatment plans may vary across culture and socioeconomic groups. For example, a clinic-based treatment plan for diabetes management may not work for patients without adequate transportation. In order to accurately study vulnerable populations, we need their participation as subjects. For example, Dr. Zuniga wanted to address the discrepancy between the rising prevalence of HIV among Latinos and their low rates of participation in clinical trials. The problem she faced involved finding out why so many Latinos hesitate to participate in medical research. To study that, her team recruited HIV-positive Latinos from the U.S.-Mexican border area around San Diego. Despite a significant percentage of this population, many of whom being poor and uneducated, falling into groups considered vulnerable, the project identified the rising public health need to study this population and was able to work towards addressing two main issues. First, how to identify barriers to enrolling in clinical trial among this population, and second, how to address and remove such barriers, thus opening the doors to greater participation in clinical trials for Latinos in the border region, with the ultimate goal of developing HIV treatment options better suited to the expressive needs of this community. These benefits show that we must actively involve and listen to those that we want to learn about, learn from, and ultimately provide for. This principle is also demonstrated in my second main point. Dr. Zuniga's research operates on a model that considers the community studied as partners, not just subjects in research. This relatively new approach is now commonly referred to as community-based participation research. It aims to engage community members in conversation with research academics in an effort at mutual understanding. For example, the previously mentioned study effectively utilized this type of partnership in working with the San Ysidro Health Center. This health center, unique to its region, offers comprehensive HIV and AIDS services, serving a significant percentage of Latino patients living just north of the border. Staff and patient advocates working at the health center, not surprisingly, are intimately familiar with the culture and health needs of the border Latino population. Rosana Scolari, Director of Operations of HIV Services at San Ysidro, is a co-investigator in several of Dr. Zuniga's projects. Representing the perspective of the community from which research subjects are from, community partners like Ms. Scolari provide researchers at UCSD with expertise and community-trusted personnel, allowing access and direct discussion with local residents that would be difficult as outside researchers alone. This resulted in having potential research subjects. Learn about the trial from case managers at the health center in the comfort of a familiar setting. In addition, Dr. Zuniga and other co-investigators from UCSD provided their health center partners access to institutional review, further ensuring that the research would meet both ethical and scientific standards. Together, the team met frequently to evaluate every aspect of the ongoing research, from budget to the order of authors on published findings, making transparent and shared decisions ahead of time with consideration for the equity of each party. The lasting relationship between community partners like those at San Ysidro Health Center and the team at UCSD was made possible through maintaining open and trusting lines of communication and a commitment on both sides to the well-being of the community under study. Finally, let me end with the principle of using what was learned from research to provide benefit to those who made the work possible. While it is impossible to always guarantee a direct benefit to individual research subjects, for example, curing the disease studied, the information generated from research should still somehow benefit the community from which the research subjects are drawn. The community-based participation research model teaches the value of giving back, ensuring that the results of research are shared and that the community benefits in other ways from participating in research, and thus honoring their contribution to the work. We see this in Dr. Zuniga's research on barriers to clinical trial participation among the minority communities, in which understanding the obstacles allows for their elimination. Initial studies involving surveys done in the clinic transformed to interviews within a context of focus groups, thus allowing for interactions between research subjects as a way of learning more about themselves. Specifically for the sample HIV-positive Latino community, significant hurdles included signs of stigma, communication, cultural differences, and difficulty in traveling between the U.S. and Mexico. While researchers and clinicians have limited control over social stigma or U.S.-Mexican border policies, they can implement means of improving communication, lessening cultural gaps, and providing information for participants regarding their legal rights for immigration. Training and education for increasing cultural awareness and better understanding of the diverse needs of different populations allows for better communication. The responsibility to actually implement these approaches rests ultimately with the researchers. The community partnership research highlighted tonight provides but a few examples of ways we may rethink human subject research. Of course, this model cannot guarantee complete transparency of all studies, for example, double-blind drug trials. However, the general direction that we have sketched in our discussion tonight rests on the fundamental importance of improving ethical conduct in human subject research, which requires continued openness to listening to those we ask to help us in advancing our common goals. The thread that connects what Dong, Niti, and I have covered tonight is the non-negotiable necessity of respecting the human dignity of all research subjects. While Henrietta Lacks was not formally enrolled as a research subject, her contribution to science cannot be overstated. As mentioned by Dong previously, the use of HeLa cells became global in less than a decade. From research in cancer, AIDS, gene mapping, and effects of radiation, to testing the first polio vaccine, the HeLa cells have been a cornerstone of countless scientific advances in the past six decades. Perhaps what this piece of history teaches us is to recognize the potential of every individual, regardless of their education, status, or wealth, to contributing something of value, something sometimes of immeasurable magnitude, to science and to society. With that thought, we would like to thank Rebecca Skloot and remember and honor Henrietta Lacks, her family, and their story. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your very useful presentations. What we're going to do, per our usual format, is to open things up to the audience. There's a microphone there. I think we just have one microphone tonight. And if people would like to sort of line up in the back of the room, we'll take questions and hear perhaps more from our panelists. Okay. Thank you.
This question is for Nateen. I was surprised that you lumped Henrietta Lacks' story in with Tuskegee and Guatemala. That they didn't seem really the same to me. But specifically, what I'd like is, what do you think now best practices would be for handling Henrietta Lacks? What would be different, and how would it affect her? Or would have affected her?
Thanks for the question. It was not my goal in my talk to lump the two cases together. As we all know, one is a medical research study, and one, Henrietta Lacks, is treated as a patient. So different rules do apply. What we are trying to link together here is the injustice that happened in both cases. In either case, there were not necessarily violations of law at the time, but as human beings, the researchers may have crossed some lines. In regards to your second point of what would have occurred differently, I think I highlighted in my talk the importance of informed consent, whether that be in a medical research setting or as a patient. I think having knowledge is paramount as a patient or a research subject. I think that's one of the things that I would say, yeah.
But informed consent means you sign a paper,
right,
saying it's okay to use my cells for research.
Right.
Do you think in a million years she wouldn't have signed that?
Was the question audible in the back, or should I repeat it?
You can repeat it.
Okay. The question was whether Henrietta Lacks would have signed a consent form that said, tissue that's being removed from you in the course of surgery may be donated or used in medical research. And the question is, would she ever have refused to sign such a thing?
I'm not sure of the exact rules, but I believe as Dong mentioned, as a clinical patient, anything that's removed from your body acts as medical waste. So I think one of the things that would have been mentioned is if the researchers had some sort of financial gain from taking out the HeLa cells. I believe that Henrietta at least should have been informed of what was happening. The surgeon just took out two dime-sized pieces from her cervix. Being informed, I think, is definitely paramount in this case.
If I can jump in here, I think one difference in the case of the HeLa cells was what happened afterwards. That is, it isn't unusual at the time, and it's not unusual now that people do research on things that are removed, say, during surgery and so on. However, there were other things that came up in the book in terms of how the family was treated by Johns Hopkins and what misunderstandings and misconceptions arose once it became evident that there was this cell line and it was being used widely in scientific research. A number of you will probably recall the discussion in the book of the of Deborah, the daughter, believing that in some sense her mother was alive because people kept saying, we have this, immortal cell line, and not much effort was done to explain what that meant. Let me also add something we might want to come back to in the discussion, and that is whether anyone thinks that the current policy on medical waste ought to be changed at all in light of advances in what we know about genetics and perhaps growing privacy concerns. As long as things are de-identified, perhaps this isn't a problem, but there are more and more things being done with bodily tissue, so maybe we can come back to that. But let me take the next question. Go ahead.
Well, some of my questions have already been answered, but I have a question about as far as the immortal part, and that has to do with DNA. In no time did you indicate anything about DNA and the fact that it specifically identifies an individual. Is there anything in what you've been studying that deals with that, or any discussion?
In terms of research, taking it and using it in research?
Yes.
The only thing I can think of is the HIPAA laws that are in place now that doesn't allow for self-identification, so whether that be DNA or some sort of marking for anything taken out of a human body, we must respect the privacy rules. But in regards to DNA, I'm not exactly sure.
Maybe I can address that. One of the things is that any research you're doing on human materials is going to fall under what we discussed is the common rule and falls under legislation having to do with institutional review board review or an IRB. And what that means is that if you're using human tissues, be they cells, be they snippets of DNA, be they, vials of blood or what have you, there are very strict regulations about what you can do with that. And typically that material has to be de-identified, coded, and so on. In other words, the research protocol and the plans need to make provision for protecting the privacy of those who donate their materials to research.
But that would have completely ended anything about HeLa cells because there would have been no identification of her.
Well, that's right.
So I don't see how in our current situation we can go back. And I really like this community-based. I think that's wonderful. And also in any way helping the individuals to understand the situation. But the idea that that my medical waste is going to be traced back to me and that they would someone would actually know it was mine, I think that's horrible.
Well, that is a concern. However, again, as I said, when we de-identify things, that doesn't mean, I mean, if you want to study something, you may need the medical profile. You may need information from the medical chart, or even if it's not a patient subject, just a healthy volunteer subject, you may want to know, for example, whether the subject presents, you know, whether they have diabetes. You may want to understand what is true of them given their family history and so on, even though you may just be looking at cells or a cell line. And we can do that through various coding mechanisms. That is, I can take your cells and have them tied to various information about you in terms of your family history, your genetic profile, and so on. What I can't do, or what the regulations are designed to protect you from, is my knowing that this patient with type 2 diabetes and a history of cancer and practice of running 6 miles every morning is Jane Smith or you. Okay. But again, there are a lot of concerns in the bioethical community about the advances in genetics and what we may or may not be able to do as we understand more and more in terms of privacy. And that isn't just true in research. It's true in other areas as well. Thank you for your question.
Thank you, gentlemen. I feel like I learned something today, and that's wonderful. I did have a question. Something intrigues me, especially given the context with the Guatemala story in the 40s. So we come out of World War II, and we have the Nuremberg trials, and we specifically point to some of the abuses and excesses. Did you come across in any of your research voices of objection or people standing up morally? What happened to those voices? Were they persuaded or prevailed upon, if there were people like that? It would surprise me that on any issue you wouldn't have people that just outright would say, this is wrong or this is against our Hippocratic oath, et cetera. Please.
Okay, excellent question. Who would like to start?
I guess I'll start. I actually did come across that.
Michael or Dong, would you like to add anything?
Yeah, it's also important to note, and I don't recall if Nitin mentioned this, but they had attempted to do the same study in Indiana as well, but it was stopped there, and then so they moved over to Guatemala and started it there. You would assume that there are people that recognize that, it's not ethical at the time.
Well, apparently, too, there's, if I can weigh in here, there's some controversy, I think, or some maybe historical investigation and speculation about the motives of the researchers and what exactly was in their heads, which, of course, we don't have access to. We have access to a historical record. But there was a piece that just came out in the Hastings Center Report, which is one of the leading bioethics journals by a woman named Lynch. And what she argues, actually, is that, and again, you know, you can weigh in on this side or not, but one of the things she argues is that the researchers, the U.S. researchers who went to Guatemala originally went for a couple of which she would argue are perfectly valid reasons. One was scientific. The scientific reason or argument for going to Guatemala was that what they had been doing in Indiana was looking at, again, the prevention of STDs, which were more of a problem then than they are now because we've just made progress on treatment. But the government was very interested in looking at this, and they were interested in looking at it in populations like the military because there was a need to understand and prevent and treat. So her argument is that American researchers went to Guatemala for an interesting reason, that they went not because they thought the ethical bar would be lower in terms of research, but because the ethical bar was lower with respect to prostitution. That is, in Guatemala, it was perfectly legal for sex workers to go into the prisons. Prisons could have not conjugal visits, but sex worker visits. And this was sanctioned by the culture, and it was legal. Whereas in the United States, the thought was, I'm not sure, you know, our Puritan heritage or what have you, that prostitution was not legal throughout most of the country. And for researchers to be using sex workers or prostitutes in their research would have been controversial. And that would have been the ethical issue, that was part of what drove them there. The other thing that drove them there, she argues, was a scientific reason. And that is that what they wanted was to be able to study the progress of, or the natural course of disease in gonorrhea and syphilis and some other STDs, when by natural course what they meant was that you got it from a sexual partner, not from somebody putting it into your body by, you know, inoculating you. And that they could do this natural transmission with the sex workers in Guatemala in a way that they couldn't do it in Indiana. And they thought that if they were interested in prevention and particularly in treatment, that it was important scientifically that the way in which the disease they were developing a treatment for arose was in the normal biological way and not in some artificial sort of thing that was part of the research protocol. So that's part of the argument. And again, we may never know exactly what was in their heads. She goes on to argue, or to ask, really, and maybe we can pursue this, why was it that having gone to Guatemala, did the ethical standards that were in place in Indiana so quickly sort of vanish, and they ended up doing much more terrible things in Guatemala than they were doing in a very similar study in Indiana. And with that, I think Mike is waiting to maybe tell us that we are out of time. So I'm going to thank our panelists.
So I do have a few things to do in closing. And the first, this has been a wide-ranging discussion, and notwithstanding that there is an entire other topic that would deal with the question of the use of animals, particularly in research, that maybe at some future date we should address, the program did begin with comments about the Dalai Lama, and I do just want to sort of tie this together to bring what I think was a key theme here today. And one of the comments from the Dalai Lama that Vice Chancellor Brown mentioned was that he talked about the need for compassion, not utility. And there are times when in order to obtain utility, or in order to obtain compassion, you need to first have utility. And that's one of the purposes of medical research. So I have a question first for the panelists and then for the audience, just a yes-no question. It's one of my famous unanswerable questions. So given that informed consent is so difficult to obtain, and I think we've had some conversation about that tonight, given what we know about Henrietta Lacks and we think what could be different today, the fact is today academic medical centers around the country, including UCSD, are struggling with an interesting dilemma. If they could take every piece of tissue from every patient who walks in the door, they could learn a tremendous amount that in terms of compassion could help us in terms of many diseases. In order to do that, they have to automatically take everything, because if you ask people, do you want to not only get your medical care, but can we use this for research, many will say no. So there are two models out there. One model is what's called an opt-in model, which says that you have to say, I want you to use my tissue, it's okay. The other model is an opt-out model, where people who have come in to the medical center for medical care are being asked, do you want to opt out of something? It's less likely that's going to happen. So you almost guarantee that almost everybody will be in the system. So we have two possibilities. One is everybody is automatically in. The other is you're only in if you say you want to be in. Just by a show of hands, how many of you say that we should do this? Everybody is automatically in so we can get the best available medical information. Any of you want to vote for that? I'm first asking the panelists, so they aren't biased by the audience. I mean, you guys, you three are the next generation. That's why you're here today. So what do you think? How would you prefer to go? And I realize I'm not giving you an opportunity to qualify your answers. You're on a panel to decide what your hospital is going to do. So do we tell everybody you're in automatically? How many would say yes? No? Nobody would say yes? How many in the audience say yes, have them go in automatically? So that's interesting. I'd say that's about, it's not quite half. So you might want to lobby your universities and academic medical centers on one choice or another. So before the final closing announcements for this evening, I want to ask you to join me again in thanking not only the student panelists and not only Dr. Devereaux for an excellent job of moderating the program, but all of you who participated in the discussion tonight and all of you who are going to continue to participate in this discussion elsewhere. So I want to thank everybody for that.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.